Welcome to the Calgary Sessions. This is episode 101. I'm in the hundreds now, which is kind of a thing. So to have you on today to be my first one in the hundreds.
It's going
to
be awesome.
Dude, it's like, it's yeah, to get you on period is rad, but to have to be a 101, this will be a fun one. So please name and who you are.
Nick Lewis, from Texas, born and raised, played football. Division II walk-on that broke every record at Southern Arkansas University that I could. In the receiving category, the last person signed to the Calgary Stampeders in 2004. Rookie of the year 2004, number two receiver in 2005. Finished my career 14 years, 11 here in Calgary, three in Montreal as the all-time leading receiver in CFL history and receptions. And yeah, still hold that record. And first ballot CFL Hall of Famer, class of 2021. So it's been a wild ride, and but I've loved every piece of it. And now I'm a coach. I coach receivers for the Calgary Stampeders. So.
And?
Awesome.
And you got that
and
going on.
And the CEO, founder of AO Sports, right? So that's always big.
That's it. That intro is obviously heavy. That's why I'm pumped that you said yes to be on the show. So I appreciate your time. And
appreciate you, brother.
Yeah, I'm a, you know, you know nothing about me. I'm a sports guy. So your reign here in Calgary, knew the name, knew the voice, saw it all. So it's not lost on me that you're actually sitting in front of me. So I appreciate it.
Indeed. It was a lot of fun, man. Whenever you go out and do what you do and people can watch it is pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, outside the lines, I'm just like everybody else. But as soon as I step inside those lines with those cleats on, it's just like, you know, I have to be the cockiest person alive. Like, you have to believe that to go out and do what you do.
Yep. Yeah, man, this is going to be a really cool show. So the gist of the show, I like the guests to go back as far as they want to go, how they grew up, where they grew up, what inspired them, how their parents influenced them, their friends, their family, their environment. And we'll kind of weave our way to where you are today. So
awesome.
Take it back as far as you want to go.
Well, I guess, growing up in a small town in Texas, 4,000 people, town of Jacksboro. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess all the blacks live on one kind of one section. We call it the flats. And so it's one of those places. It's in North Texas, probably about an hour and 15 minutes from Oklahoma. And, you know, about an hour, hour and a half from Dallas, Fort Worth. So kind of in there, but real small town Texas, man, real backcountry. And I understand that I went to school with the same people each grade all the way up. So it's kind of like it's really cool as you get older and start playing sports together. Because when you're in little leagues, you compete against each other. Mm. And then when we get to middle school in seventh grade, we start competing together for the first time and understanding how that dynamic works, that you play with the same group of guys from seventh grade all the way through your senior year of high school and what you want to accomplish in varsity sports.
Yep.
Right? And we know Texas is a real big place for football.
Massive.
I always hated football. I love basketball. I hated football because, one, in August in Texas, it's always too hot, too humid. So I hated being out there. I like being inside. And I remember going into my freshman year of high school. I told the coach, like, football coach, I'm not playing football. He was like, no, you're playing football. You're not playing basketball. And so that's how I started playing football. And well, not started playing. I started playing in the fourth grade, but – that's how I started playing in high school, you know, continue to keep playing the game. And I was very small. I was 5'1", 114 pounds. And we didn't have a freshman team. We were too small. So we had a JV team. So most of our JV team was made up of our freshmen. And we were just playing everybody that wasn't playing on varsity. And we did pretty well. I had a pretty athletic group class ahead of us. And with ourselves, man, we did pretty well. And then we moved up to 3A for 2 years, man, and the A classification in sports in Texas is really cool and unique. It's not unique, but it's really cool because they take your attendance on one day, and they'll go to the top, and they'll take everybody's attendance and say, okay, how many do we want in 6A? Cross it out. Then they go to the bottom, how many we want in 1A? And they'll cross it out, and then they'll start dividing up in the middle to see where you're at. And it's all about your attendance that day at school. And so we went to 3A. We were one of the smallest 3A schools, so we were playing a lot of schools that were bigger than us. We went 1-9 my sophomore year on varsity, my first year on varsity. I go 1-9, and I think we only scored 6 points in district. And we lost 6-49 that game. And the rest of the games were, we got blew up by over 50.
No way.
To nothing.
Did you, were you playing both sides of the ball, or what did you, were you playing?
For the most part, I was. Played a little bit of receiver. Played a little DB, not very much. And then I hated DB. Like, I hated playing DB. I wanted to play safety, if anything. My sophomore year, I grew a little bit bigger. I was 5'4", 145 pounds.
Monster.
Still a small guy. But then I had a growth spurt during the summer going into my junior year. I went to about 5'9", about 170. And at that point, you know, we came back in, just knew that we were going to have our chances to do some really cool things. And that was the point we went down to 2A, right? We became the one of the biggest 2A schools. So then it was like, okay, yeah, we can now compete with a little bit better with some of these schools. Like, we had, we would have 8 starters go both ways, like start both sides of the ball. We only had about 23 players on our team in football. So played all special teams, doing everything. But just from a compete standpoint, playing some smaller schools, you understand that they're in the same situation as you. You're not playing against teams that have 30, 40 kids out there, and it's like, man, this is crazy. But junior year is when I really started coming to my own. They moved me to defensive end. I was All-State defensive end, played receiver as well. We went 3 rounds deep in the playoffs, lost that game. What a fun ride that was. And then going into my senior year, we lost a lot of our great athletes from that class before us. And they were like, we need you to play quarterback. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, you can touch it 5 times a game playing receiver, or you can touch it every play playing quarterback. I was like, all right, I'll play quarterback. So I played quarterback and defensive end my senior year of high school.
Why do you think they wanted you to try it? Were you like over the top athletic? Were you like way different than people, or like why'd they ask you?
I was never trained, right? So it was kind of like a raw product where I could break tackles, I could do things, but I never really was like really fast. But I was always breaking tackles. I was always making these spectacular catches and doing different things that you could tell I kind of set myself apart from a lot of people athletically. I always felt like I moved so different on the basketball court. Because the first time I ever dunked a basketball, I was 5'6", you know, and I could toss the ball up in the 10th grade. I'd toss the ball up and then I could go up and dunk it. And so athletically, I did have some skills. I just felt like on the football field, they just didn't look as well as they did on the basketball court. I felt like I was a whole different person. The way I move, still to this day, the way I move on a basketball court is completely different than a football field.
But how so? So I've seen you move on a football field for a lot of years. How do you explain the differences?
I mean, I just think I'm way more explosive on a football field. On a basketball court, as far as I got long arms, I play really good defense. I'm a slasher. I can get to the hole. I used to play here at the Talisman all the time in the summer. Me and Cope. You had to dunk on a couple of people back in the day. And and if you're watching. But it's just one of those things where we just had a lot of fun playing basketball. I love basketball. I actually went to Red Deer with a group, and we won a basketball tournament out there.
When was that?
Oh, man. That had to be like 2007, 8.
That's way back. Okay.
9, somewhere in there. Yeah, it was, you know, playing, what, 4 games in 2 days. It was a lot. You know, I think we beat Eddie Richardson's team in the championship, right? So that's a popular name around here. He does a lot of great work with the kids as well. But, you know, I just feel like I just move so different. On the football field, I know I'm not the fastest guy, so I never really run.
Yeah,
it's almost like I just stride around and just use my strength to break tackles. I'm like, I got to save my energy to break tackles. I know I'm not outrunning DBs when they're the fastest ones on the field.
Yep.
Right? It's just like when you see the lion circling, you know, you got to – sometimes you got to stand your ground and fight.
So quarterback.
Yeah.
So you finish it out as a quarterback.
Quarterback, defensive end.
Yep.
2-year All-State defensive end. Played quarterback, and it was one of those things where quarterback allowed me to see the field, see the game differently for the first time, understand what everybody's doing on the field, really opened me up to understanding football, not just what I was supposed to do as a receiver, not just the simple form of things, but it really allowed me to understand the game at a higher level. Played in a basketball all-star game my senior year, and I was one of 3 guys under 6 foot, and didn't get a lot of run. When I, even with practice, I felt like I was one of the better ones. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was like, probably don't have a big chance to go play basketball anywhere.
Yep.
Got an opportunity to play in a football all-star game. Played receiver and got MVP of that game. Ended up walking on to Southern Arkansas University as a D2 walk-on.
Did you, when you're coming up, like coming up through high school?
Yeah.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do? Like, you're just getting into ball. Did you think it was like a route you could take to get into college?
Well, it's something that I've always wanted to do. I don't know if I really had the belief that I could. There was nobody in my hometown that really went and played football after high school.
Yep.
It's kind of like one of those things, glory days of Texas. You know, you play for your high school team. Mm-hmm. You represent your high school team. It's something that I've always thought, listen to other people. They tell you, like, hey, man, you got a shot to go and play college football. Going into my senior year, my head coach was like, write down your top 10 schools you want to go to. Mm-hmm. I never gave him a list. Right.
Just because it wasn't in the realm of possibilities in your head? Well,
until that basketball all-star game, I wasn't playing football ever again after that football season. Or, you know, I remember before our last home game senior night, I looked at my dad and was like, I don't even want to play today. And I feel so bad now because I feel like I robbed some of my teammates because I could have been better. I could have, you know, wanted to do things a little bit better. And it just didn't matter to me at that time.
Yeah.
On really playing football, I was ready to get the basketball. You know, if you're in the playoffs in football, you're starting to miss basketball season, right? So it's like, I'm ready to go play basketball. And it was just one of those things where I was really focused on basketball. I really thought I could go play college basketball to some level and do some things to pursue that.
Yep.
But after that basketball all-star game, I remember breaking down to my mom, and it was like the realization that if you're going to go do something, football is the sport.
Which is, when you're all in on basketball, that's a spot to be in at a young age.
Yeah.
Just to deal with that kind of disappointment, just like
huge disappointment. Man, yeah. I broke down. I was like, I just remember being in the car on the way home. It was like 30-minute drive. I was bawling. I was just like, Mom, I don't get it. You know, to have your dreams kind of crash at a young age.
Yep.
Like that, and it's not somebody telling that you can't do it. Like this self-realization, like I'm not going to do this, right? I don't believe I'm going to get an opportunity. I'm 5'9 and a half, 5'10, you know, 175 pounds. Like I'm not just a physically demanding person, and it's not like I'm not a great shooter, but I could get to the bucket. I can play great defense. I could do a lot of things that made me special on the basketball court. But I just realized at that moment, that was the night that basketball really died for me as far as not my love for it, but just understanding that I was never going to play college basketball.
Where do your parents fit into all this? As a youngster, like growing up, did they push you into sport? Did they see that you were a natural athlete, or was it just like trial and error, just like go try something?
So my mom is, she's like my sister. My dad is like my brother. I grew up with my grandparents from 6 months old. You know, my dad was in college. He played basketball at Texas Tech in college. And my mom she actually later on got a record with Jive Records, or got a record deal with Jive Records. She used to sing and do things. No athletic ability whatsoever. My uncle had Olympic trials out of high school, full ride to Notre Dame in the 70s and didn't take it. My aunt played professional softball and professional basketball against like Nancy Lieberman Klein and all these other ones. She's a super athlete. And here's my mom with no athletic ability whatsoever. That's the singer. And her son becomes the one. So it was kind of cool in that aspect. But they were always my supporters and my grandparents. You know, my granddad worked in the oil fields and he showed me what hard work was. And my grandmother, she was a stay-at-home grandmother that she used to all take care of everything. Take care of everything in the house, cooked every day, made it sure we had everything that we needed for the kids. And it was good. So I had a great childhood as far as just growing up, feeling loved and having the people around me that supported me.
Yeah.
At an early age, my grandmother never missed any sporting event from soccer, baseball, basketball, football, no matter where it was or what it was, she never missed an event. She was always there. And it was I always feel like it's important to look up and see, but it meant a lot to know that she was there mm-hmm. all those times. But as I got to high school, then, you know, my dad was there, my mom was there, you know, my grandmother was there, my granddad was always working. Sometimes I'd see him parked. He'd park his truck at the back of the football field and he could actually look and see. So it was really cool to see that too. But
that work ethic, when did you figure out that it was like wildly different? You know, like as a youngster, I watched my dad work like a very hardworking man. It's not until I'm older now that I can look back and understand what he was actually doing. It's unique, hey?
To me, I'd say college. Mm. Because when you grow up in a small town and you have the athletic ability that I had, I was always pretty much going to be one of the best ones without even working hard. Mm. And I didn't really know what hard work was. It was just like, I'm going to show up and I'm going to be one of the better ones. No matter it's track, basketball, baseball, football, soccer.
Yep.
I'm playing everything. And like, I'm going to be, if it's basketball, there's not five guys in this town better than me.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
There's probably not one or two, but at the same time, I always knew that I could compete for it. But it wasn't until I got to college and they actually wanted me to play quarterback. We ran the option.
So let's wind it back before you get to the hard work.
All right.
So you come out of high school, you're like, I'm going to try the football thing. Basketball's done. Just as a flyer, you're like, I'm going to walk on?
Yeah, so my dad paid someone to do a little highlight film of me. He sent it out to a bunch of colleges, got a couple of responses. We went to Southern Arkansas on a visit, met Coach Halfley and the receiver coach at the time, met the head coach. This is probably May, like right before the All-Star game. So April, May, and I told him, you know, I'm going to come. And so when I went and played in the All-Star game, it was a junior college that had the coaching staff. They actually offered me a scholarship to come to the junior college to play. They're like, you come here for a year, and then you can go anywhere you want to go, right? But I've always been a man of my word and, like, commitment, and I wanted to be committed. I've already told them I'm coming. So mm-hmm. I'd rather walk on to honor my word. And I went on and walked on there to Southern Arkansas. So it was a good thing, though.
What does that actually feel like? You know, just like walking on and doing that? Did you have the inner confidence to know that you had it? Or was there like moments of self-doubt? You're like, there's some players.
I wouldn't say it's self-doubt. East Texas at the time had the best high school football in Texas. Mm. I guess the player of the year for East Texas that year was the number one recruit, and he was a receiver, and he was going to Southern Arkansas, right? We traveled four receivers because we ran the option.
Mm-hmm.
I was 12th on the depth chart out of 12 guys. And it was one of those things that start training camp when I would go to the coach and say, hey, I'm not a quarterback. I'm a receiver. And he's like, all right. Like, pretty much really didn't care. Because, like I said earlier, when I got there in or when I went to that visit in May or April or May, that new coach, or he was coaching there, he had left. So it was a new coach that took over.
Mm-hmm.
John Bland had took over. And so meeting John Bland for the first time is when I got to training camp and, you know, one of those things. But I don't think they really cared. It was just like, all right, go be 12th over here at receiver,
mm-hmm.
you know, instead of 5th or 6th at quarterback, go mm-hmm. be 12th at receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was one of the, like, I would see him making one-handed catch, and I'd make a diving catch, and he's making a diving catch. And it was one of those things where I fell in love with competition.
Mm-hmm.
I never had fallen in love with competition. I've always wanted to win, and I've always had this drive of how to win. And, you know, in games, even at a young age, I'm like, okay, if we got to score this much to get back in this game, or we got to, you know, keep them at bay for this long to have a chance to win the game. So I'm always going through in my head. But it wasn't about the competition. It's about winning.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first time that on a daily basis I went to practice and I started getting better because I knew that I wasn't the best one.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I had to compete to win. And I fell in love with it. And mm-hmm. it was like a challenge, like, oh, they think they're better than me. And then I kind of adapted this motto: you show me who the best one in the room is, and give me a little time around them, and I'll be better than them, right? Because like Michael Beck was the number one receiver at the time, and fast guy, super fast. wasn't a great route runner, made some plays down the field. Then it was Jason Bennett, who was a great technician and, you know, wasn't super fast, but great technician, played the game really well. Somebody I really looked up to watching him play the game. And then Dante Curry was a tall receiver, very tall. He was like 6'4", 6'5", rangy guy that could make great catches. Wasn't a great blocker and doing things like that, but really could use his height and understood how to use his height. He came from Sealy, Texas, which is used to be a powerhouse back in the 90s mm-hmm. as well. But, you know, just understanding who those guys were and then incorporating all their games into one,
mm-hmm.
right? And even Juan Bedoya, who was the freshman with me, seeing how he did things and what he was doing. And it's just like, mm-hmm. I'm taking in everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching their games and I'm taking it in. And I think the greatest impact was one day near the end of training camp, one-on-ones, I called out like one of our best DBs and I beat him. And, you know, I just showed a lot of confidence. And he's like, you're going to be something, you know, mm-hmm. and when everybody else starts noticing it,
yep.
that's when you start really taking it in. But I just woke up every day to compete for the first time in life.
And back to your grandpa, the work ethic, how did that catch you? Is this part of it in college? Yeah. Where it was like, when you wanted to figure this out, you had to work at it?
100%. Yeah. And, you know, he just taught me, like, put your time and space into what you want. Understanding how he provided for our whole family. You know, everything that he did, from working in the oil fields and coming home, mowing the churchyard across the street, mowing our yard, mowing the neighbors' yards, doing all these different things. It's yeah. like there was never a day I didn't see him work, mm. right? There was never a day I didn't see him work. And now sometimes, you know, building AO, I'm working from sun up to sun down, or coaching, putting in a 14, 16-hour day, or getting back from Toronto at 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, you're back in the office at 7,
mm.
and you still got to get done what you have to get done. It's just like understanding how to work and not minding, knowing that your work is in due process for what's going to come and how you're going to benefit.
Yeah. What is that? Is that just trusting the direction you're going in, or just trusting the work you're putting in is going to get you there?
100%.
Is it blind trust, or is it just
faith?
Mm.
I'd say faith and trust is the same thing,
mm.
right? So many people say they can trust someone, but you have to be in a position to trust someone to trust them. It's the same with faith. You have to know.
Mm.
Like, if you trust someone, like, take my best friend. If I trust my best friend, I don't have to question if he's going to make the right or wrong decision or whatever the case is going to be.
Yeah.
I trust him, right? I have faith in my God. I have faith in, you know, the higher power that allows me to do what I need to do and mm. to maneuver the way I need to maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that's just the biggest thing, is my faith and my trust in not only the people around me, but myself.
Mm-hmm. So what starts happening when people start acknowledging that you got something? So this is like your first year still, or second year?
Yeah, first year. Yeah. By the end of training camp, I was fourth receiver on the depth chart. So they actually chose me over Juan for the fourth receiver spot. Michael Beck was a senior, Dante Curry was a junior, and Jason Bennett was a sophomore. And so here I am, the freshman, and I thought I'd made it because I beat him out. We come back the second year. I had no catches my first year. I probably played in probably 20 plays of the game that season. I remember mm-hmm. times being like, I want to transfer, thinking I'm better than I am. My yeah. dad's like, dude, one day you're going to be up there and there's going to be a young kid come in and you're going to be frustrated if they try to put the young kid in front of you. So it was just like, just keep doing what you're doing. Mm. Don't worry about how it's playing out. Just do what you're doing. I got the paperwork to transfer to North Texas. Ended up didn't send them in. Came back second year. I'm still fourth on the depth chart. Juan Bedoya is third on the depth chart in front of me. So I realized at that moment they chose me because they wanted to redshirt him because they thought he would be better in the long run. Mm. By the end of that training camp, I was second on the depth chart behind Jason Bennett. Three, four games in, running straight down the field, he tears his ACL. I still remember to this day just watching him run and then just fall. And then that's when I really got my opportunity.
Mm.
I had over 100 yards in my first game. finished my first year with just over 500 yards receiving, pretty much, and I think I had like five touchdowns. And at the time, it was kind of like, I remember against the best corner, my best friend, Ted Williams, he's the quarterback, right? We came in together. So we're in a game where it's going back. We were up by like 21. They came back. We're at their place. Came back. They tied the game up. For some reason, there's like 40 seconds left in. They squib kick it. And then we run a fullback dive because we're just going to run the clock out. Our fullback breaks it like 50 yards down to like 21-yard line. Time's run out. We call timeout. Come to sidelines. Coach looks at Ted. What do you want to run? He said, man, I want to throw the fade to Nick. You know, going against the best corner in our division that year, I was like, let's do it. Run the fade, catch the touchdown. Finished the game with over 100 yards and three touchdowns that game. And it was like one of those things that just sitting there in the meetings the next day, and the head coach goes, I think we found another playmaker. I look around my teammates, and they're like, man, we've known you've been a playmaker. Like, I was like, I thought I proved that a long time ago. But if you're just now finding out, then that's cool. And that's kind of what led to those last 2 years is really coming into my own and being able to be the first 1,000-yard receiver in team history, being able to go out, put up 14 touchdowns each my junior year and my senior year. And, just really understanding, like, the confidence level, just the growth and how sure I was of myself and how much I trusted myself on the field and just allow my athletic ability to just flourish.
Where is that the mix of like trusting and like putting in the work, and then where does the ego fit into that? Do they need to be like work together? Like, do you need to have that self-worth?
You have to.
Plus the work ethic?
Like, I think that's the biggest problem now is there's so many people, no matter if you're an actor or a musician or an athlete or whatever the case is being able to turn the ego off. You can't become who Michael Jordan is. You can't become who Kobe Bryant. You can't become LeBron. You can't become the greatest athletes. You can't become, you know, all these great people without the ego.
Yeah.
Now, my biggest thing was I knew early because I've always been a sociable person. And hanging around my friends, I've never felt like a celebrity or even to this day, but it's just one of those things where I know that I'm the same person as everybody else outside the lines. But inside the lines, I'm the baddest you've ever seen. And I will challenge anyone, any day, anywhere. And I know what I can do. And that's my mentality. But I understand it's only in that realm do I hold my superpower. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And when Clark Kent don't have the Superman cape on, he's not Superman, no matter how much he wants to be, you know? Yeah. And you got to understand that. For a lot of people, they find it very hard to turn that off because they take their superpower outside that realm.
Yep.
But other people have superpowers outside that realm. And their superpowers can be better than yours, you know? So.
So it's like self-awareness too, right?
100%.
Understanding that. Between the lines, outside the lines is kind of
that's it.
How you operate. So as you're putting up all these wild numbers your last couple of years, where's your head at? Is it focused on school? Like, does school fitting into anything? Do you have like, what's your vision at when it's over?
So I always went to school, health, kinesiology, and recreation, minor in education to be a coach. I was going to coach high school football, and never had any kind of thoughts of playing at the next level.
Yeah.
Going into my senior year, I remember going, or after my junior year, I played really well. My dad noticed and he was just like, all right, one, you're not a 9-to-5 guy. You know, I'll tell you this. I had one job in my life. And in high school, I used to haul hay, cut yards, cut down trees, do like the
work.
Grunt work.
Yeah.
Just for cash, right? But actually having a job, from a temp service, and it was like, you're going to work from 2 p.m. to 10. And it's just putting, like, basically these boxes, cardboard boxes come down this line, and you just have to print it and then put the little paper in each one. If the cardboard falls, the thin ones used to fall a lot, so you have to restack them. And it's like that. But it's 120 degrees in this warehouse in the summer in Texas. Then I get there, and they're working from 2 p.m. to 2 a.m. I'm like, hey, I'm in college. Like, I have a nightlife. Like, I got things to do. Like, I signed up from 2 to 10. I didn't sign up from no 2 to 2. You know, even though the job wasn't hard, mm-hmm. I just didn't have that mindset. Like, yeah. I want to be in here. I want to be out there enjoying my life mm-hmm. at the same time. So I worked that for 5 days, made $550 in 5 days, and yeah, I told him I can't do this.
Like, bounced.
Yeah, that was the only job I ever had. So using that information, and my dad had actually bought me work boots to work this job too, like $200 work boots. So he was mad. But using that information, my dad was just like, you know, if you want to play at the next level, you need to improve on a couple things. And he found me a guy, Nick Scott, Pioneer Track Club out of Arlington, Texas, and that tested my will. Mm. And going in, the first time I ever had training, we'd work out at like noon or 1 o'clock in the summer. It's the hottest part of the day. Mm-hmm. And we start off with a 400 in under a minute, run around the track. Then we go through a track workout where I'm doing hurdles and doing all these different things and running and learning to run for the first time and doing all this extra work, and it's hard work. And then we finish, after an hour, we finish with a quarter under 400 under a minute. Booking. And that was 3 days a week, you know. And then at the same time, my cousin, who's my trainer, trained me all through my pro career. He was managing a 24-hour fitness, so I'm going over to the 24-hour fitness 3 or 4 days a week, and I'm working out with him. And in a couple of days, I got to work out with Ronnie Coleman.
No way.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, I was working out with Ronnie Coleman and some other guys. And I remember one time we were all doing leg press, and they were so impressed that I could do some of the stuff that they were doing. And but then they put on extra weights, and I'm like, I think I'm going to drop it off there. But no, just incredible people. But, yeah, and that was the first time I really, outside of practice,
yep.
that I really put the work in. And that's when my dad said it. He's like, I knew at that point, you making the decision to do this through the summer, like, I understood at that point that you invested in yourself. Mm. My numbers weren't better the next year. And sometimes we always look at numbers and be like, oh, well, how do I work harder and do more and become better and then don't have the numbers? And it's all circumstance and everything else. But I still put up another 1,000. I still put up 14 touchdowns. Mm. Still did really well. And after every game, teams, you know, people would be like, can't wait to watch you play next year in the NFL. Can't watch to play next year in the NFL. Mm. I remember I scored 3 touchdowns on another team, and we're walking across. We had to walk across the parking lot to the locker room. And a guy runs up, taps me on the shoulder, and as a fan from another team, I'm thinking, I don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. He's like, man, I just want to shake the hand of the man who beat us. And he shook my hand, man, and he was like, man, you're awesome. Mm. And, you know, so people around me seen it.
Yep.
But at the same time, I still had the reality, like, that's not reality. Like, we still go back to the dorm after games and watch Tennessee play. We watch Ohio State play. We watch Texas play. We watch all these schools play. Mm. There's thousands of kids there. Mm-hmm. Why do I think I'm good enough to compete with them?
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? Yep. And like, I understand on this level and what the circumstances, my competition level, I do what I do, but just didn't have that belief. I remember my roommate, we're in the cafeteria one day, and he's like, if Eddie George ran through the hole, I'm smashing him. I'm like, dude, there's no way you're smashing Eddie George. But then understanding now, after playing pro sports, he's right. Right? He'll win his fair share of battles, and Eddie will win his fair share of battles. So it's one of those things where it's like, where I believed in myself,
yep.
I still had that line, like, okay, the belief goes to here. But we're not believing the rest of this stuff on the NFL stuff.
So knowing that, your dad's saying, like, you know, 9 to 5 is not for you. If you're gonna do this, take it seriously. What are you thinking? What are you thinking when you're done school? Like, where did you have a spot where you wanted to play? If the NFL was like, you're aware that you're like, that's not it, did you have another idea?
No, just coach. It was the biggest thing was like, I'm going to get my degree in health kinesiology recreation and go coach.
Yep.
And and just live my life.
Yeah.
You know, understanding that I love to help people and love to do those things. Mm. But the day after our last game, I had two messages from agents. And sometimes it's a flicker of hope that creates a wildfire. Mm. Right. And what, for me, it was like, if they seen something, like agents aren't just going to call you if they don't believe that you can do anything.
Thousands of kids in the States.
Yeah.
Thousands on thousands that are playing that sport.
100%. Mm. And Andre, he called and I ended up meeting with him. Alonzo Highsmith, who was the who played running back for the Houston Oilers, I watched play growing up. My granddad was a big Warren Moon fan, mm. so he's watched the Oilers all the time, and just you know he's a scout for the Green Bay Packers. He came to one of the games scouting somebody else. He saw me, and he called his best friend Andre and said, "Hey, we believe this guy can play in the NFL," and. You know, hearing that from Andre, who just joined a new agency, the agency out of Dallas, and can't remember his name off the top of my head, but first agent. But he had Marion Jones, Tim Montgomery, all these. He's a big track agency. Wow. And this is, you think in 2004 when Marion Jones was at the height of her career, you know, making over $40 million in endorsements every year, and it's like, although I never got to meet her, I'd love to have met her. But, you know, just seeing that just made me feel more comfortable. And, you know, I signed myself out of school for the spring semester and went to Dallas and began working with her trainer, Llewellyn Starks, who's now one of the top guys at Nike, who's been there for a long time. But, yeah, that's where the journey began. It was like, all right, we got to go back to work.
Hmm. That little flicker.
Yeah.
Just enough. Like, once that little flicker, was it just that you could like lift your eyes and look a little bit further than where you thought you could go?
You know, I just always believe in, once you believe it with your heart, you know, anything's possible. Mm. You have to be rational about it. Like, did I know I had enough talent to play? Yes. Did I think that other people believed that I could do it? Because you got to understand, like, on campus, Southern Arkansas is a sports school. Most of the kids on campus are athletes. Mm. I'm one of the top baseball teams every year, one of the top softball teams every year. My brother's wife just went into the SAU Hall of Fame 2 weeks ago, softball player, right?
Amazing.
And the biggest thing is we look, and I've seen a couple guys go to the MLB from my school. Seen some guys do some things. Not really. Fred Perry was another CFL player. He got drafted to go to the NFL, and then he hurt his knee and then came to the CFL. I knew Fred. So I wouldn't say it was like a shot in the dark.
Yep.
Jordan Babineau, who played 9 years for the Seahawks and 1 year for the Titans. You know, we went into school together, and we competed against each other a lot. So there was I wouldn't say that it was just like all cut and dry, like I didn't think I could do it.
Yep.
But once I got the call from the agent, it kind of verified.
Mm.
Like there's that small hope in there, but then that verified. And once I felt like they believed in me enough to reach out, I believed in myself enough to put myself to the test and go try.
Mm. So what'd that look like? What'd that journey look like?
Another hard journey, man. A lot of work. Mm. Show up for a private workout for Green Bay on a wet field, did horrible, but still felt like I was in their plans. I punt returned my junior senior.
Hmm.
Our punt returner kept dropping the ball, so they're like, at least we know you'll catch it. And I ended up averaging like 21.9 yards of punt return my senior year of college, and took a couple back to the house for touchdowns. And biggest thing for me was like after that moment with Green Bay, another time I just broke down. Like, I don't know if I just blew it.
Mm.
I don't know what's going to happen. I know I'm already projected. Like, on their boards, you kind of read the message boards. They're talking about me replacing Antonio Chapman as the punt returner and fifth, sixth round pick. Mm. Draft comes and goes and nothing, right? My agency had said, you know, you're going to be in a camp. We just don't know which one. And I realized at that moment, if you don't have connections in the NFL, you don't get in.
Right.
Right? There's a lot of people that are in there because of who their agent is, because of connections. Maybe you have another player that we want that's going to be a free agent next year.
Mm.
And we'll do it as a favor so that we have a chance to get this person next year.
Yep.
Right? So there's all different types of things that go on in those rooms and conversations. And my agency just didn't have enough connections to make it happen. Mm. I remember they called me the day after the draft and just said, hey, we haven't got any phone calls. We got a phone call about you playing for the Arkansas Twisters Arena 2 football team. At the time, my cousin had played arena football for 8 years, and I'm very aware of the game. He played Arena 2. He played Arena 1. But Arena 2 makes $200 before taxes a week.
No.
So I'm thinking I'm just going from playing in the NFL to playing for $200 a week.
Mm.
I said, I think I'm good. And then I talked to my mom about it, and she says, son, you're going to play football for a long time, and you need to go to the workout. And I did.
Hmm. When your mom says that, is it, do you have a choice to say no? Or when she says something like that, you just have to like, yes, ma'am.
My mom was always the type that I felt like her relationship with God was so strong. She was like, God already told me. Mm. Right? I've already claimed it. I already know what's going to happen.
Mm.
She's like, son, I'm not done watching you play. I get so much joy out of watching you play.
Mm.
And, you know, it's one of those things where you just watch, and she just breathed life into me again. Mm. Right? Every time I felt like I went through a hard period, my mom or dad was there for me to breathe life back into me.
Mm.
Right? They gave me that ability to go back within to say, all right, let's just go back to work.
Because those moments of like the downs, you know, like those are emotional times, right?
Yeah.
As a high performing person, to have the downs, it's tough to handle.
It is. Especially when you're like, I'm not going. Okay, I'm going. And you've committed yourself 100% that you're going.
Mm.
I mean, that year I went to the Super Bowl with Andre, and I was with Alonzo and Andre and Donald Driver and Greg Jennings and all these guys, and I'm like, oh, like I'm a part of the team. I'm already thinking I'm a Green Bay Packer. Like I'm already a part of the team.
Yeah.
And, so it's just some of those things that disappointments and different things that really hinder.
Mm-hmm. So you go to this workout.
Go to the workout in Arkansas. Me and Jermaine Trent, who was Jermaine played at Cincinnati, played in the NFL. He was kind of almost like my handler, per se. Mm. Anything I needed with the agency, he took care of. And really cool dude that understood the journey, right? And somebody that I could really tap into to learn from. We get there. I think I'm going to a workout. I show up. First of all, Mark Super Duper is the coach. Or no, Flipper Anderson. Sorry, Flipper Anderson's the coach. I remember watching Flipper Anderson with the Rams, and I'm like, dude, this is awesome. Like, how are you in Arkansas coaching this team? First of all, so I was in shell shock of that first, you know. He was the head coach. He's like, all right, so you brought your cleats? I said, yeah. He goes, you're going to practice with us today. I was like, all right, it's not a workout? He's like, no, you're just going to practice with us. So then we go out to the practice field, you know, guys in the huddle, then they're like, all right, get in the huddle. We'll tell you what to do. So I worked my motions and did different things. I just looked so natural. I felt so natural watching my cousin do it all those years.
Mm.
Right? So I understood the arena game. I understood a lot of the stuff. Practice, and it's almost like every catch I scored a touchdown. And he was like, can you start for us this weekend? And I said, well, I have a workout with Calgary this weekend, like one of those workouts that they do in the offseason. And he's like, John Jenkins was the head coach here last year, who's now the offensive coordinator at Calgary. And he's like, I'll call him. And I said, well, if it doesn't work out, I'll come back. So went back to Dallas, got off the flight, felt really good about the workout. Still wasn't sure about playing for $200 a week at that point. But I didn't have any money. I mean, I was a college kid that just got out of college, and Went to the Calgary workout. I caught 51 of 53 passes in the workout. The only two I didn't catch, I didn't touch. I didn't even finish the workout. It was so hot. It was like a 4.5 hour workout.
It was down in Texas?
Down in Texas, in Colleyville. And yeah, I started cramping up. Couldn't even finish the workout. I just remember after the workout was over, I told John, I said, all I need is a one-way ticket. You get me a one-way ticket and, you know, I'm staying. Just very confident after at that point of what I could do. And, you know, I see other talented receivers there that's played pro football and I'm fresh out. And, you know, out of 100 and some guys there, I was the only one to make it to training camp. Matt Dunnigan calls me 3 days before training camp and says, hey, I remember I'm laying there on the floor watching TV at my cousin's house, and he's like, hey, this is Matt Dunnigan, head coach and general manager of the Calgary Stampeders. Sounds good, doesn't it? I was like, hey, Coach Dunnigan. He's like, man, I was watching your tape, watch your highlight film from college, watch your workout. He's like, I think you're a really good athlete. We want to bring you in. I was the last person signed to the roster in 2004.
Matt Dunnigan.
Yeah.
Wild. 2004.
The next day, I'm at one of my best friend's weddings. 2 days later, I'm getting off a flight in Calgary for the first time, going to Canada, which I knew nothing about.
Perfect segue. Because that's a stretch, right?
Yeah.
Small town Texas. You know, you went to college, experienced some things, but to go like that far north to a league, did you?
I'd watch one CFL game, at least part of it. It was like the 95 Grey Cup or 94, one of the Grey Cup.
Rockets?
No, I remember Calgary's playing. Okay. I remember watching Doug and Jeff, and it was snow on the ground, snow everywhere, and I'm just like, how are they playing football in this?
What is happening?
And like 95, what? I'm 13 years old, so like I'm old enough to know, but not really putting a lot of stock in what the CFL is. Mm-hmm. I have no clue what it is. I mean, to me at that point, it could be Australian football, right? So I'm not really – I remember I watched it maybe for 10 minutes, and then I was either gone or doing something or watching something else, but not put a lot of stock into it, but never thought I would be going to Canada to play football.
So you show up here. This is 04, you said?
04.
Okay.
Yeah.
What the hell is going on in your head when you're
21 here? Years old.
20. You're young.
Yeah.
Wow. So what are you thinking? What do you think when you land here? That I'm curious. Yeah, I'm very curious to see what you felt, because that's like for all the reasons, like just on the lifestyle, the league, the dimensions, like all the changes you're about to feel. Where was your head at?
You know, the crazy part was, even when I got, when Matt called me about coming here.
Is he from Texas, by the way?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't even look at the field size, the dimension, the game being different.
Downs,
I
just looked at nothing?
The roster. I knew nothing else about it. I knew some of the players on the roster. Right? I'd watch Wayne McGarity play at Texas, which is my favorite university. I'd watch Albert Connell play because most of my family loves A&M. And, you know, so I'd watch a lot of these guys play and do things, but I'm more so who's on the roster. Where am I going to fit in at, right? Didn't really care about anything else. I guess I was too naive to even think about anything. Didn't even consider being cold or anything like that. I just remember at the airport, this older couple was like, are you coming to Calgary to play football? And I said, I am. And I was like, tell me a little bit about Calgary. And they're like, it's broken up into four quadrants. Knew nothing about quadrants and understanding how this city is broken up. And I'm just thinking, I'm like, I don't know what's about to happen. I get off, Doug Rook, old Dougie, picks me up. And he's like, thought you were going to see Eskimos, didn't you? And I was like, I didn't know if I was going to see it or not, but it would have been cool if it was. But then I remember passing, you see a McDonald's and a Burger King and like a Wendy's. And it's like, oh, I'm at home. Like I feel like I'm in the same place. Like I'm not expecting anything different at this point. Get there and go to rookie camp.
So, sorry. As you're looking at the roster, what are you thinking? You know, there's guys, there's names. You know where they've been, what they've done, and you're putting yourself in the order. Does it feel like you're about to be in a competition?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Right. Who's the best player in the room? I go back to that same part. Who's the best player in the room?
What do you do? You just watch them?
Watch them.
And then just like, once when it's your time to go, you just turn it on.
That's it. They already know what to do, right? I'm watching them. I'm paying attention to everything they're doing. Mm. I'm trying to pick up any clues, any cues that I can get to improve myself. And I remember going back to high school, there was a time that I asked the coach, could I come off the bench? Because if I could sit on the bench and watch their best player for 2 minutes, I could stop him. Mm. Like, I just watch him and I understand what it takes to stop somebody, but I understand what it takes to beat somebody. Mm. And for me, it was just that mental mindset of not only having, like I said, that trust in myself and a belief in myself, but I just needed to see what it was supposed to be like. Mm. And then I could go and apply myself to it. Mm. And that's the way it was. And I mean, it was a great group of guys. I remember
Who's in that era? Dude, I'm a sports guy, so I remember all the names. Who is that, like, who were the guys on that team?
In Calgary?
Yeah.
Oh, man, coming in, Wayne McGarity, who was so dynamic as a punt returner, a smaller receiver that can make people miss, didn't take clean shots. Albert Connell was on his way to becoming the first receiver to have 1,000 yards in the NFL and 1,000 yards in the CFL. Mm. Before he tore his abdomen, the year before, and then he tore his ACL like 5 games in. He had like almost 600 yards in like 5 or 6 games.
Crazy.
And he was tearing it up my rookie year, and then he tore his ACL. You know, those were the two biggest guys that I was like, man, that's crazy. Mm. And then over in Edmonton, you know, watching Terry Vaughn and, you know, Jason Tucker, you know, Ed Hervey. Mm-hmm. They had a crew over there.
Yeah.
BC had Paris Jackson and G. Roy Simon and Jason Claremont.
Wow.
Montreal had Cope, Kwame Cavill, Ben Cahoon, Thyron Anderson. Mm. You know, all these teams, you know, Mookie Mitchell, I think, might have been in Edmonton my first year, or he might have just went to Toronto. Mm-hmm. And, you know, seeing Mookie Mitchell over there in Toronto with the guys over there. So it was like, there was like, every team that is looking around is like, dude, there's a lot of ballers out here. And, you know, can't leave out, you know, Milt Stegall and Robert Gordon, you know, and those guys doing their thing over in Winnipeg either. So it was like a who's who of the CFL. I used to sit back and watch Giroir and Milt a lot and Terry Vaughn. Because everybody, like early, everybody's like, oh, you're like Terry Vaughn. You're like Terry Vaughn. Terry's a little shorter than me, a little thicker, but Terry was at one point in my career. You got to remember, I was very skinny coming in. I was like 197 pounds.
You were?
Yeah. I can show you a picture, man. I was small. If you go back to 2004 Lou, I was Lil Lou. Yeah. But I could always break tackles, man. And in playing in that option offense in college, I always cracking back and always blocking. So that was my mentality, is like being a part of game. So.
So what starts happening when you get to the CFL? You know, like, find your groove early. Are you just like, what is it? What's actually happening?
So when I get here, getting to training camp, one, it's the hardest thing I've ever been through.
There's been Klassen said the exact same thing. Like, he was, you know, him telling the stories. He was like hard.
Well, if Clawson's a 10, this is 100. Because, like, now they pretty much protect you from a lot of this stuff.
Right, because this is
we were doing 2-3 hour two-a-days full pads. Mm. Now you can't even wear pads more than 4 days in training camp.
Right.
4 or 5 days.
10 to 100.
Yeah.
Noted.
You know, we got fined for over-practicing, you know, by the PA. So it's like one of those things where we really had a hard training camp.
Yeah.
John Jenkins is a workhorse. It's like, if you're not in, you're running routes or you're catching passes. Like, you never are still for the whole practice. Mm. But, you know, it was my hardest training camp of 14 years. That was it that first year. Mm. Just remember, man, been in there, and Darnell McDonald was a great receiver as well. He was playing with a torn ACL, and had a knee brace on. He was balling in practice, you know, watching other guys. Every time they called the ones, I would get in there. Andre Arlane or would come over there and say, "Get out of the huddle, rookie." And until one day they didn't tell me to get out of the huddle anymore. And I started my first preseason game against Winnipeg. I think I had 4 catches for over 70 yards, did really well. Then the second preseason game, I think went to BC and thought I did all right. Didn't have the numbers, but I thought I did enough in training camp to earn a spot on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess no phone call is a good way, you know, of knowing that you made the team. So I was nervous, but at the same time, I felt confident.
That feeling, like, that's an accomplishment, right?
Yeah.
Like, just back it all up to the beginning to actually, like, show up different and all the differences, right, and to make the team.
You know, I made a video on my cell phone the night before I got on the plane, and the video just kind of reminded me of why I'm coming, right? My family, myself. I was like, you know, I know it's going to be hard. I know it's going to be challenging, but I know why we're going.
Yeah.
I know what we're going to accomplish. And it was just kind of like going back and watching that video while I was there to make it through challenging days and make it through hard days and to go through some of the things that it just allowed me to reaffirm to myself, like, you know why we're here.
Yeah.
Right.
Your introduction to yourself, who you are, the laundry list of the accomplishments that you've achieved in the CFL is obviously massive.
Yeah.
Very unique. Like, one of, just like stellar. Could you have ever, you get through that first rookie camp and you're kind of like, holy hell, I'm like, I'm here. Could you have ever imagined that any of those would be on the board?
No.
What were you thinking after I'm here, I made it. Then what are you thinking? Every year, every time you show up to training camp, you're like, I see the guys that are there. I know the guys that are coming. I need to secure this spot. Like, it was every year, just the same every kind year of grind. The
same mentality.
Yeah.
I remember after my rookie year, I just went over 1,000 yards in my rookie year. I had 1,045. And remember getting back in the locker room. The first thing I did, I told the media, I'm no longer Nicholas Lewis. I'm Nick Lewis. Because we had a sign that said, don't speak. Let your play do the talking, right, as a rookie.
Mm.
So I'm no longer a rookie now after this game.
Were you quiet the first year?
I was boisterous, but I was quiet, like, around people, like in the media and stuff mostly. But I was pretty boisterous on the field, like in between the lines, but not in the media. That really came out in 05.
Nick showed up?
Yeah. And then, you know, just going through everything that I've been through and just like, I'm Nick Lewis now. And this is going to be my worst year that I have. And I was so dead set on, I'm going to destroy this league, right? And I knew that I had the capability of doing it. But then you go back to the realization. And Jim Barker says he doesn't think I'm good enough to make the team 2005. You know, I was just a good receiver on a bad team. More fuel to the fire.
A lot of fuel.
That's it.
And then what happens? So what do you, when that's said, what do you, like, how do you internalize that?
I just take it as other people's truth. And that's okay. But, you know, we brought in Henry Burrs, got here in 05, Jermaine Copeland, Kenyon Rambo. Joffrey had played the last 5 games of 2004. He's coming back. Ronnie Jenkins. Marte Jenkins was there as well, who played 6, 7, 8 years in the NFL. And I understand you got guys that are coming in that are all taller than me. They're all faster than me. They all have different games than me. But that's okay, you know. I remember, like, it was early on, my roommate, my rookie, was Salacio Sanford. Salacio had played for the Chicago Bears. He was the MVP of NFL Europe 1 year. He played arena football. And they tell us in training camps, either you or him are going to make the team. And we both ended up making it. We were roommates. And we competed against each other every day. I supported him. He supported me. He had been through it. He used to always tell me, he's like, Nick, like, dude, you're that dude. And I'm like, no, it's Salacio. Like, you know, like we're good, but he used to always pour into me. And I was very fortunate. Even Albert Wayne McGarity told me, like, he said, "You're the best receiver I've seen straight out of college in a long time." And I was like, man, that meant so much to me, because, you know, you see so many guys come and go, and just understand the work ethic, and all. I just wanted to prove that I belong on the same field as them. Like, here I am, Texas A&M, Texas, all these, you know.
Like heavies.
Yeah, Middle Tennessee State and Southern Arkansas. Right. Then you got Ohio State leading receiver from 98, Kenyon Rambo.
Really?
You have Jermaine Copeland, who backed up Peyton Manning for 2 years at Tennessee before he became a receiver with Peerless Price and won a national championship in 98. And, you know, you have Marte Jenkins that has been a beast in the NFL. It's this super fast 4.2 guy. Like, super fast guy at 6'3", 6'4". And I'm just here like, all right, we got to be us, but we got to be the best version of us, you know? And I remember they cut Salacio in training camp because one of the guys we brought in, I think his name is James Terry, because Nate Terry was the DB. It was one of the two. Was DB our rookie year. They brought his brother in from K-State to play receiver. And Salacio was starting in front of him. And he goes to him and tells him that he's not getting an opportunity to play. And they cut Salacio. So then I remember, I was like, I'm not going to the meeting. I took, you know, personally, like, I'm just like a 22-year-old kid. That's my best friend right now. Like, you just cut him for no reason. He had been playing well. And Cope pulled me aside and said, "Hey, bro, you got to remember, you're part of the reason I came here." And all I knew is they didn't want me here, right? Because they didn't think I was good enough to be here. And then when Cope told me that, it was kind of like, all right, Batman, I'll be Robin. I'm ready to go. And that's when we built our, formed our relationship. And it was the most impactful relationship that I've ever had.
On and off?
On and off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just the support, just being synced up, like aligned on the vision, or just...
Yeah. I mean, you take a kid that has no clue. There's 4,000 people in my high school. I mean, my hometown. There's 12,000 people in my college town. Now I'm in Calgary, where there's 700,000, 800,000 people at the time. And I love to party. I love to hang out. I love to, you know, just chill. But, you know, understanding work is work. To finally have a direction and to have somebody that was, that one, you can depend on through anything, and two, was such a great leader and did everything that I needed to make, to allow me the opportunity to become who I became. Like, I honestly don't believe I become who I became without Jermaine Copeland, because yeah, I could still go do the things I do, but I'd probably do it for four or five different teams.
Right.
Yeah.
Does he know that? You guys, he does. You guys are like,
yeah, he does.
That the likelihood of that happening, you know, to find that person like that early in your pro career.
Yeah, it was so impactful. You know, he used to call me the little pit bull because I always played with it, such an edge.
I remember that.
But I was like a dog, like watching them off the field, watching them on the field, Kenyon, Cope, like the gratitude that I have for them for taking me in. And understand, I was 5-6 years younger than them, and they had been through some things, and they knew my random craziness. But it's just one of those things that they really took me in and allowed me to really flourish into it. And we always competed with each other. We never felt like we competed with a defense. It was always like, oh, Rams gonna make a play. No, I'm gonna make a play. You know, Cope's gonna make a play. And that's the way it was.
There's listen, I'm not trying to talk on my ass now, but there's some teams that have amazing chemistry, team camaraderie, all of it. In your tenure, is there moments in time where there was like specific teams that have just all happened? Like it was just like a brotherhood, it was like alignment, it was everything? Like where that feeling with that connection with you two, was there teams where that, it was like through the whole roster?
Yeah, I thought that in a couple years. 2008, 2010, 2012, and 2014. I thought those years, it was just like, it was almost like clockwork to step on the field and, and just go to work. Like, no matter what happened, like, we knew that we were going to do big things. That was the year, 2008 was the year Cope got married. He was like, hey, bro, I don't want to go out on road trips. Cool, I'm in. I didn't go out on road trips. Brother wasn't going out, I wasn't going out, right? No, understanding how that played a factor in a lot of different things, right? Yep. I mean, the same year, him and his fiance and me and my fiance at the time went to Cancun on a bye week. Like who goes to Cancun on a bye week for four you know, was it 4 days, three nights or whatever it was?
Yeah.
Drinking copious amounts of liquor, hanging out, going jet skiing, just relaxing. But I understand when we got back, we wouldn't beat Montreal. You know, it was one of those things where it didn't matter. We knew what we were going to do. But, yeah, it was just, there was huge alignments in those years. And it's crazy just saying it, like, I say like every 2 years is like 18, 12, 14.
Yeah, you're rattling. I was like, like, what is that?
I have no idea.
Is it like to create, if you did it every year, that would take a lot of energy, momentum.
But each year was different because the dynamics changed. Like 2010 was the first year Cope went to Toronto.
Okay.
And that was, he called me and was like, hey, bro, I'm going to Toronto with Barker. So they're going to trade me today. And I remember just being down. He's like, you know how to lead. You know how to do what you need to do. He said, it's your time. You know, and it's for the first time, like, no matter how well I was doing on the field, I was always like, that's Batman. I'm Robin. You know, that was the relationship that we had. It was just like such huge amount of respect.
Yeah.
And, you know, 2009, at the end of that year, Rombie Bryant came here. And so Rombie, it was me, Rombie, and Rambo. And Rambo, I remember that, just magical on the field. I think we averaged close to 37 points a game that year. I had 1,260-something yards and 10 touchdowns. Rombie had 1,170-something and 15 touchdowns. Rambo had 1,170-something and like 8 or 9 touchdowns. Mm-hmm. Joffrey had over 1,300 yards rushing. Cornish had 700 yards rushing. Hank had 500 yards rushing. I just felt like as a machine, as close to a machine you could be. Mm-hmm. We started off 9-1. And, yeah, like it was – there was such alignment in that team. There's no, we felt like there was nothing we couldn't do that we wasn't going to win.
Is it like a quiet confidence? I mean, when the machine is like moving at that kind of velocity, you just know, or is it like,
oh, you know,
you just,
you know,
just every, like, everywhere you show up, you can
look over, you look at each other.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just one of those things where you're all in sync at that level. You know, it's like no matter what chaos is going on, no matter what's happening in our worlds, it's like, this is how we come together and accomplish what we do. You know, in 2012, KG taking over for Drew when Drew got hurt and just being that quiet leader. You know, at that point, Rambo was out and now Marquay McDaniel's in. You know, it's me. You know, I went from me, Cope and Rambo, to me, Rombie and Rambo, and then me, Rombie and Marquay, you know.
You were this, like, you were the common denominator.
Yeah. And then it went to me. In 14, it went to me, Marquay, and Eric Rogers, right? And Joe West and Mo Price and everybody. So to be able to see all these great receivers come through and to be a part of it and the alignment from it is really special.
Yeah. What is, how many Grey Cups did you win?
Two.
Which is
awesome, but we didn't win enough.
Yeah, yeah, because you guys were.
Yeah.
That 10, that
I
machine
thought 10 was like, the best year I've ever been a part of. Yeah.
What fascinates me about talking to pro athletes is the transition after their sport.
Yeah.
I'd love for you to kind of just let me in on what that looked like for you. You know, what that transition actually, what you went through.
Transition started difficult. 10 days after I 10 days after I retired, the next day, I went to training camp with the SAS, Saskatchewan Rough Riders, as a guest coach. And then about 9 days later, found out my mom had pancreatic cancer. Mm. So I ended up leaving training camp there, and then really tapped into spending more time with my mom and, you know, going through that battle.
Yep.
You know, it was kind of like I've always wanted to coach. I got my foot wet coaching there for a couple of days, but then it was like, okay,
yep.
What am I going to do now? And then I pitched a TV show idea to Paul Graham, the executive producer of TSN. Hmm. And he loved it. He asked me to join the panel. And I was like, man, I don't want to join the panel. It's not long enough. It's too structured for me.
Right.
I need more leeway.
Just like dig into things more or just to like let it like shine.
It's not enough time to let things breathe on there. It's kind of like they're rushing to point to point to point.
Right.
And then the game, and then you rush to point to point to point back to the game. And there's not enough time to let things breathe or to really explore really what's going on.
Yep.
When they used to do long pieces, it was Brian Williams doing a piece on somebody. It wasn't really the panel really diving into a lot of different things, but I pitched him an idea. And it's funny now, like it was facts and stats with me, Derek Taylor, and Ryan Phillips. Hmm. He loved the idea, said it was going to take about 18 months to get it done. And in that meantime, me and RP went to coach together in BC with Devon Claybrooks.
So the coaching idea in you from a young kind of age, right?
Yep.
Be evolved, coach. You, like, as you developed your personality and your brand as you were playing, like, you became a thing, right?
Geronimo, Simon Sleepwalker, your Master Unique, Chow Young Fat Swag.
I forgot that one.
You know?
But, so you're getting this, you found your voice, right? You're like, you're a brand.
Yeah.
So when you're done, this idea of like being involved in media, because you know a lot, obviously there's a bunch of pro athletes that are involved in media after the fact. Were you okay with either or?
I was at the time. It was like I'm okay with going either avenue, and you know, kind of after BC, you know, we coached in BC, and November of that year, the end of the season, I said, well, I'm going to start a podcast. And
what year is this, sorry?
2020.
Okay.
So at the end of 2020, to end of 2019. End of 2019, I was going to start a podcast.
Yep.
I created an idea that formerly was AO Sports. It was PO, and then my sister was like, you can't name it PO Sports for players only. Like, no, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And then that's when we came up with AO for athletes only.
Okay.
So we went and I started my podcast in January of 2020.
Yep.
And during that same time, you know, from the transition, I knew two things. One, I wanted to create something that was a team environment because I felt like through my whole life as a teammate, I could always perform my role. Mm. I didn't want to do anything individual anymore. You know, there's 2 years of outside of coaching, like I just hated individual. I felt like I talked to a friend that's doing something similar, and I'm like, why won't we do it together? Why can't we help each other? Why can't we be more teammate-like than individually driven to success? Why can't we all get to the place together? And each person had different reasons why they weren't getting to where they wanted to get to, right? And there's a lot of hurdles in there to get there. So I was like, I'm going to start a podcast. And then I pitched my show idea for a CFL show to Paul Druin, the executive producer of the Rod Peterson Show, who is IKS Media, the founder of IKS Media in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. I pitched him my idea. He's like, I'm in. We're going to do the show during the CFL season. We started to explore the options of sponsorship. I reached back out to a lot of connections I had here in Calgary, started securing sponsorship for the show. COVID hits, everything shuts down. So now where I was gonna show people what I was gonna do and then show them the company idea, I just had to build. So now I built the company, and then that summer, I pitched it to Paul Druin. who's now 36 years as a second generation broadcaster, 23 years owning his own media and technology company. I'm thinking if he gets it, we got something. He joined. He said, I'm in. So he's my chief content officer. And that's how we started AO Sports, is through me building it, pitching it. And I pitched it to the advisory board members and the rest of the executive team that I have. And, 4 years now that we've been building this thing, ready to launch it.
And what's the genesis of this idea?
Teamwork, bringing more access to your favorite athletes and your content creators, understanding how we can enhance the brands of current athletes. We can build the brands of future athletes, and we can extend the brand of ex-athletes through content. But also bringing everyone together. It's a mix of Netflix, ESPN, and social media all in one hub. And we can actually increase your monetization, because YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, all these platforms are not built as monetization places. They're places you can monetize, but they're not built for you to monetize, right? It's like a bowl of money, and then they just ship out pennies. It's like the machine at Chuck E. Cheese. You put the quarter in, and you wait for the thing to push the money over, and you just keep pushing it in, and you get what you get, right?
Yeah.
But to truly have a platform that's built around monetization for athletes and for sports content creators, that was the vision, and understand how we can help. So we're really bringing athletes along, because they have some great ideas, and we understand that most of the athletes that we talk to are driven already, and they will do the work. They just need branding or marketing or production support or some of those things. So we can help them in all those facets, and then we just distribute the content through one platform.
Where'd this idea come from? It's very dynamic.
Yeah.
You're bringing a lot of cool pieces of the industry together and centralizing it.
Yeah.
How did you, and this is fascinating to me. You don't know my background at all, but I have a digital storytelling business.
Yep.
So when you can imagine as you're talking, I'm like, holy shit. So what was the driver to bring all this together?
Championships. Understanding my role is only important as everybody else's role to succeed, right? What is a championship team? How does everyone feel important from a member that comes to the platform, from someone creating content, from somebody on the board? Everybody wins at the end of the day, right? And it's an everybody win mentality. I'm tired of people having to choose whether you win or I win. I want us all to win together and all understand that we all can get to a place in life where everybody is happy, right? As a member, you're getting the content you want to see. We have AO Evolve, where now you can get sports-specific training from athletes. You can get fitness and exercise, nutrition. We have professional development, where we have NIL directors. We have financial literacy experts. We have Dr. Rob Kelly, who I was telling you about earlier, with the 97% addiction recovery success rate.
Yep.
Right? We want to put people in our way that allow us to become our greatest self. Right? And that's what I've always wanted to do, is chase my greatest self, whether on the field or off the field. How do I wake up on a daily basis and find my greatest self? And it's a journey that we're all on. And I feel like if more people had that mindset, they wouldn't be more worried about today.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, it's like, you can accept where you are as long as you know where you're going. What's hard to accept is where you are when you have nowhere to go. So if we can give people a place to go and give them supported networks, then we can now begin to create destinations, and more people will find happiness, and more people will find, the value is in the journey. And at the end of the journey, we get to smile one day and just be like, I either did it or I didn't. We're going to create mentorship programs, and we just allow athletes and creators to really create their own. So if they want to come to us and create a program, we execute it through them, because we're global. We have athletes in 9 different countries. We have over 100 athletes and creators signed in 16 different sports, and from Olympians to NFL Hall of Famers to NBA to rugby to soccer. We have 2 of the top 10 racquetball players in the world. Cool. Right? Everybody has value.
Yeah.
Every sport has value, and every sport has a fan base and a network.
Mm-hmm.
And we just want to utilize that to bring them all to one hub and benefit off each other.
Yeah. You and I touched on this off camera, the idea of community.
That's it.
This, like, as you're explaining this whole idea, I'm like, it's community.
That's it. We just want to create the ultimate community, mm-hmm. and the ultimate place for people that they can find value.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to go and we're going to do a lot of amazing work. We have the AO Sports Impact Foundation, and we have a partnership with the LA Chargers, and we're going to do community events with them. Mm-hmm. We're going to do community events at Super Bowl, at Grey Cup, at World Cup, and different things. We're going to travel the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to bring our members with us. We're going to bring our athletes. We're going to bring our creators. We're going to mm-hmm. bring our sponsors. We're going to create huge amounts of impact in the world.
Mm.
And then at night, we'll celebrate.
Mm.
And it allows you to work from wherever you want to work from.
Yep.
As long as you're focused on what is your impact and how are you creating a space that allows the growth for everyone.
You've been building this for 4 years.
Yeah.
Quietly? Quietly? Is that
pretty quietly.
I've released
some names out there, like some board members.
Yeah.
Like Dr. Jen Welter, the first woman to coach in the NFL. You know, Devon Claybrooks, Tad Cornegay, Garrett Jones. You know, I have some great board members. I have some great executives. Just brought on advisors. Greg was a former president and CEO of CNN for 28 years. And then he went to become the president of Endeavor,
wow.
which just bought the UFC and WWE, which is now a $21.9 billion company. He was the president and brought on the former head of brand for Endeavor as well. As advisors to the company.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I sit down and talk to them and they're like, I want to be a part of this.
Mm.
You know, that's the cool part is like when we sit down and talk to athletes, it's like, all right, I want to be a part of this.
Mm.
Can I bring other athletes with me? Yeah, let's go. Mm. You know, and it's so great to see what we're going to have the ability to do.
Yeah.
Because we can 100 times pay what YouTube does.
Mm.
And it's not even going to be close.
Mm.
And there's going to be, for me, I'd rather make 1,000 millionaires than become a billionaire.
Yeah. How are you balancing CEO, founder, and coach? Or do you have a roadmap of what this looks like for you?
So going into it, I thought about one thing. If I was going to coach, I needed to have a co-CEO.
Hmm.
And first of all, I found out, like, at the end of a call one time, this young lady is like, you know, you're like a chief encouragement officer.
Hmm.
And I was like, you know what? I am, right? And I encourage my team to be, and I tell them all the time, I'm like, what you do well is the reason you're here.
Yeah.
You don't need me to tell you what you do well. You already do it, right? And you're already self-motivated. And like, how can I tell Paul Drewin about content? Hey, Paul, like, we're going to do content. We're going to do, like,
got it.
That's the first way of failure.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like I have the right people in place.
Mm.
And so Nicole Delaney is my co-CEO. She is a powerhouse, and she's done philanthropy all over the world. And she's worked with Mark Zuckerberg and other major companies in really for kids and the support of kids and doing things. And she has such a great personality. And I know she holds AO as her own.
Mm.
And so she became my co-CEO. And she was the chief impact officer at AO. And now she's the co-CEO. Mm. And she'll still be working on that side of things. But for where I'm not there, she's able to fill in the gaps. Mm. And for me, coaching is coaching, right? I love to do it. It's a lot of hours, but there's always times in the morning or at night or gaps in the day that I can fill space with to do certain things. You know, anytime we're meeting with athletes, I'm still on those calls. I'm still, you know, very front facing to that side of things because I enjoy it.
Yep.
You know, it's an athlete driven company and by an athlete. And that's why a lot of people love it.
Yeah. Because that's unique, right? Like,
yeah.
You have the perspective.
Yeah.
You have like their best interest in mind.
100%.
Mm.
And they know it's just not a businessman just thinking about money.
Yeah.
They understand that we're truly building one of the greatest teams to ever exist in the world.
The work ethic it takes to pull this off and be a coach. Straight up work, right?
It's work.
Like work, work.
It's work.
Like it's not.
It's work.
Yeah.
You know, I still try to find enough time to play video games and do things, but
yeah.
The amount of work that, especially building, like building by yourself, the hours that you have to put into it.
Yep.
Okay, then you put hours in and you find something wrong. And you're like, okay, then you got to retread and go back and do it and do it. It's a lot of, lot of different trial and error on your own part. But then once I started pitching it, then I started defining it more.
Yep.
And then their ideas helped define it more and more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And the organic growth that we've have in our athletes, we haven't paid one athlete to join. They all want to join to be a part of our platform.
Cool.
You know, some cool athletes too. We brought on Christy Martin, the first female boxer to fight on pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
She fought under Mike Tyson card as the co-main event.
No way.
Yeah, and she's got a documentary on Netflix. You should check it out. It is amazing. It is an amazing documentary, and they're doing more. So she's a promoter. We'll be having our own events. We'll have boxing events,
cool.
MMA, other type of sporting events. So, hey, we're just here to take over.
Period.
That's it.
Since I got you, the idea of high performance in sport and how it transfers into business.
Yep.
Do you feel... you feel there's a strong connection there? Do you feel like the lessons learned in sport around all the lessons are transferable into the business world? And do you feel, I'm curious to see how you think about that.
100%. I think there's two paths, right? I think that one of the biggest things for me is meeting with a lot of business people. I understand we speak a whole different language. And where sometimes you have to believe more in yourself, and because they look for your weaknesses and they look for you to not feel confident or to feel like, you know, sometimes they'll give you advice and not all advice is good advice, because at the end of the day, they do business to make money.
Mm-hmm.
I do business to really create for people. Right, create spaces and to do things. So we have a total different alignment on what we're doing. For me, as far as football goes, that ultimate belief in yourself and understanding when I put my mind to it, how I can accomplish it. And every day that I do have a doubt, like, why do you believe that you can create this? Why do you believe that this is even possible? I think back to my younger self and said, becoming the first ballot Hall of Famer wasn't possible. Playing pro football wasn't possible. If you say it's a dream that's too good to be true, then my life is not true. So therefore, I no longer have boundaries. I no longer have borders that limit me, because the first act of my life, which was football, knock down all the boundaries that, and all the, you know, why a small kid from this small town that believes that he can do this, how he can believe he can change media, or believe it, he can change the world, or believe that he can do these things. And the belief comes in people's smiles when I tell them about it. The belief comes from knowing what I've already accomplished and understanding that success and failure doesn't exist, right? You're not a failure in life. Even when you do things wrong, you're not a failure. You always have, as long as there's time on the clock, you always have a chance to right it. You always have a chance to correct it. You're only a failure if you don't, right? At the end of your days, people will look back and decide if you're successful or you're a failure, right? And for me, I feel like I'd be a failure if people only remember me from football, right? Because that's such a small impact on the lives of others. Well, now I'm really wanting to make a bigger impact and help other people make bigger impacts so that they can feel successful in their own lives.
Those moments of like self-doubt, when you're questioning it, like, do I have this to like create this media thing? Do I, like, how long do you sit with that? How long do you let that occupy space in your brain?
Oh, man, it's hard. Every year I'd come back, it would always be a play that I would make that I proved myself, well, I can still do it. Because there's always the doubt. Like, you hear doubt from everyone. Oh, yeah. I remember going into 2007 or 8, some fans were like, you should trade Nick. I think he's done. And, you know, I had those conversations with my owner, Ted Heller, and, you know, people are always going to doubt you. People will always doubt you. And it's hard to say that you truly block it all out.
Yep.
But you have to internalize it. You have to process it. But then you have to either let it fuel you, but understand that if they're not looking at the same thing you're looking at, how can they tell you what you're looking at?
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? Mm. They don't have the lens that I'm seeing this through. Mm. They don't understand what the end goal is. Maybe from their perspective, it's not a possibility.
Mm.
But from mine, it is.
Mm. You're taking such a big swing at this, at AO. Like, this is a lofty, lofty goal.
Yeah.
Feel like you have it? Feel like this is like your very, that confidence you played ball with, this is your...
I do.
This is the business move.
I do. Awesome. And I know the one thing we're not going to do is go spend a bunch of money on creating content.
Yeah.
All we're doing is investing in people to allow them to invest in themselves.
Mm.
Right? And that's why we will be successful, because we're taking successful people and just giving them team around them to continue their success.
Mm. What's going to be fascinating to watch is this journey, you know, to whatever version you this is of your life. You know, there's the ball career, and now there's this.
That's it.
This, however you phrase this second part of it, is going to be very interesting to watch.
It is.
Like,
it's an interesting dynamic to be a part of. Sometimes I still don't believe I'm a CEO.
Mm-hmm.
I remember 11 years ago, I went to Halloween as a CEO clown. I put on like a suit with a tie, and I had this clown head on with these huge glasses, just making fun of CEOs because it was kind of like the persona.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nowhere near my world.
Yep.
But it just goes to show, we don't know where we're going to end up. We don't know what's going to happen in our path. But if you've got the right team around you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who is Nick Lewis without Henry Burris and Joffrey Reynolds and Jermaine Copeland and all these amazing athletes, all these amazing coaches that allowed me to do it? And now I'm just doing the same thing. I'm just putting it into a different realm, right? We're creating teams where we have amazing teammates that allow you to go out and just do what you do, right? If all you do is great content, we'll find people to help you do the rest, right?
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
All these life lessons in sport that you've just like cherry picked and now you're executing in the business world.
Yeah.
It just goes like click. It makes so much sense.
Some guys get mad at me though.
Who?
We were talking to one group. They're doing something kind of similar, but it's all individuality.
Mm.
And that's one of the biggest things that sets us apart.
Yep.
Is we talk team.
Mm.
Of course, if you individual and you got the rock, then the rock's going to do well. It doesn't mean everybody else is going to do well.
Mm.
Right. So when we talk team and we talk about the two top 10 racquetball players. Oh, I get to be on the same platform as, yes.
Mm.
I get to share, yes, right? I forgot where I was going with that, but.
It's like, it's that click, right? It's just taking all those sport lessons and putting them into this business, the clown. I love the clown CEO thing. the one thing I was going to ask you is like, how do you vet these athletes? Of all the characters that are out there, you know, you have access to thousands. How do you vet who comes into the system?
You know what the crazy part is? We don't want to be huge. We want to grow it. Like, we're going to launch about 20 athletes and then a few athletes weekly.
Okay.
Right? We sit down with the athletes and we discuss with them, what impact are you looking to create?
Mm.
Do you have a foundation?
Mm.
Do you want to support a foundation? Do you want to create a foundation? What kind of content are you looking to do? You know, understanding all those variables and then sitting down and seeing how they want to drive it forward. Okay, where do you need help? And then we do contracts with all of our athletes because contracts locks them in because of exclusivity behind the paywall and all those different types of things. Yep. But still giving them the freedom to do anything outside of AO as well. So we're not saying everything you do has got to be on AO. They actually choose what part goes behind the paywall, what part is free on their channel. So they have a lot of freedom, and they maintain 100% ownership of their content, whereas other platforms now own it.
Yeah.
And like YouTube, you put us on YouTube, they can now repost it for their own purposes without paying you.
Yeah.
All right. So all those things play a major factor in, as an athlete, having ownership, having people that are supporting you. We have a death clause in our contracts that allow their families to continue to get paid from the work that they're doing, because it's not just about today. Yeah. We do things for legacy and for our families and our future. Right. So we just want to put people in a better chance to succeed than feel like they got to be in a rat race alone.
Yeah. Dude, this has been awesome.
I appreciate it, brother.
Dude, to sit across from you, like, it's so fucked up. You know, like, yeah, it doesn't, that's the crazy thing about this show.
Yeah.
I get to sit across from 2-time Grey Cup winner, first ballot Hall of Famer. Then we get to talk about your journey. And the cool thing about this experience is, you know, 2.0 of you.
Yeah.
It's going to be cool to watch.
Always recreating yourself.
Right? Yeah, man.
Anything's possible.
I end the show with one question.
All right, let's do it.
When I say Calgary, where's your head go?
Second home. Love this place. I hope to call it home again very soon. So, looking forward to moving back.
Well, what is it about this city that's got you? Obviously, you spent a large amount of your life here, but what is it about this city?
You know, I just remember the Calgary that was always growing, the vibrant city. From 2015, I just remember that was the year I left to go to Montreal, and just remembering that was the year also the hit with oil and gas and everything started to go the other direction. And just always wanted to help come back and rebuild, help come back to restore. Because as a 21-year-old coming to a new country and being in a place for the first time, the embrace that I felt from the people here, not just from fans of the game, but, you know, Brock Shepherd, who started the Nick Lewis Nation, who wasn't even a CFL fan. He was a Buffalo Bills fan who moved to Calgary, came to a game, and really wanted to represent me and who I was as a player. Those things empowered me to become even greater. That really changed the... A lot of people thought I was really cocky and young and, you know, didn't like me very much. But then I felt like the Nick Lewis Nation helped shift that to really see how involved I am with the fans on a daily basis. And, you know, showing up to a tailgate party before I play a game, you know, just the commitment that I have to say thank you for supporting me, that I support you as well.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, man. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate you.